How are you guys doing? Great. It's a tough topic that we'll address today. Can we get my computer on the screen? There we go. Thank you. I do travel quite a bit, and quite often when you sit in an airplane, people ask you, you know, what's your name? You tell them what your name is, and what's the next question? What do you do? I hate that question because I don't know what to tell people. I just wear so many different hats. I am Pastor Mendoza's pastor. My job description is I'm the pastor of all the pastors. So I have about 100 pastors and their families for whom I'm their pastor. If they've got marital issues or any type of issue or any struggle, they call me. In order to do that, I'm a board-certified Christian counselor. I have a doctorate in pastoral psychology and family therapy. And I'm not saying that to puff myself up. I'm just saying that so that you know why I'm addressing the topic that I'm addressing today. I do a whole bunch of other things as well, but I won't waste our time with that this morning. Let's get right into our topic of abuse this morning. And I'd like to just share with you some sad statistics about abuse. Because we don't physically see the abuse most of the time, we're not aware of its prevalence. There are churches, because of the church shootings we've had in the last 2-3 years, having meetings about how can we protect the church from a gunman walking in and starting killing people. Do you know the odds of that happening to your particular church is minuscule? And yet, the statistics of abuse, as you'll see, is so prevalent, and yet we seem to be ambivalent and not do anything about it. So here's the sad truth. Before the age of 18, 1 in 4 girls would have experienced some form of sexual abuse. 1 in 4. Do you know 4 girls, 4 ladies? 1 in 4, average, have been abused before the age of 18. What about boys? Before the age of 18, 1 in 7 have been abused. So if you know 10, 20 people, you know 3 or 4 people that have been abused, on average. Now, you might not know that they've been abused because they might not share anything. But the deep pain that they struggle will be there. What is even more sad is when people rob your house or mug you or steal your car or whatever, it's typically people you don't know that do that to you. What is sad about abuse is that over 90% of the perpetrators who commit this are actually known and trusted by both the family and the victim. Before abuse takes place, there's typically a phase of what we call in psychology grooming. So grooming is where a perpetrator starts getting to know your family, and they're so friendly and trustworthy. And they become your best friend. They become your children's best friend. And they start gaining your trust so that you as parent will allow them to spend more time and more private time together. 90% plus of these abuses are done by a person who is well known and trusted by the family. They prepare. And I don't have time to go into all of that, but here are some things to look for. If you spot somebody that has an extremely close relationship with one child but not the others, or 1 or 2 kids but not the others, just be on the lookout. Obviously, if it's a family member, that's slightly different, but if I'm high-fiving your kid and I'm having a good time with your kid, that's fine as long as I'm that way with all the kids. These perpetrators zoom in. They start off being nice to everybody, but before long they identify the family or the one or two people they want to zoom in onto, and then they foster special relationships with that one person. 99% of these perpetrators have multiple victims. In the previous 5 years, I was the person at the conference office who dealt with all the accusations of child abuse within the entire SDA system for our conference. Now, some people must say, no, these statistics are overblown. You don't know the real truth. Well, let me just tell you that in the 5 years that I did that for the conference, we dealt with about 30 cases. Most of these cases don't actually come to light until 15, 20 years after the fact. Most of these cases, the real hurt and the real damage actually hits you 20 years down the road. About 30 cases that we know of. And in every one of those cases, there's multiple victims. The lawyers I work with have been doing this not just for our conference, but for multiple conferences. The insurance agent, who herself is also a lawyer, does this for seven conferences, four states. Both of those two lawyers have over 35 years of experience. So combined, we're talking 70 years of experience doing exactly this for four states. Neither of them have ever had a case where the perpetrator only had one victim. Not one. All of them have multiple victims. And that's the reason why, if a perpetrator is convicted and becomes a registered sex offender, that person is a registered sex offender for the rest of their lives. And the reason is because there's no known cure. Unless God performs a miracle, there's no known cure. Those desires will be with them throughout their lives. So what can you do to help? I can tell you the most heartbreaking stories. As a counselor and a therapist, I've dealt with many, many people, many couples, many individuals that have been abused. Some of them 60, 65 years old, and they still have not recovered from what happened when they were 8 or 9 or 10. The consequences are dire. It messes up their marriages, their parenting, their relationship. And we'll get into some of that a little bit later. But I can tell you a story, and I have permission to share, otherwise I won't, of a guy who walks into my office. He's approximately 30 years old. He doesn't have a single relationship that's successful. Not one. He walks into my office and he says, I'm tired of this. I want meaningful relationships in my life. And I say to him, well, of course, because we're created relationally. We're created to want to love and be loved. And if you're not having that, you will not be fulfilled. There'll be an emptiness, a void in you forever. And he says to me, how can I get healing? How can I fix this? I start listening to his story. At the age of 3, one of his very first memories, he was driving down the road in the back seat of the car with his dad driving. He started crying. He can't remember why, whether he was wet or hungry or whatever, but he started crying. And at the age of 3 years old, his dad yelled at him, cursed at him, and when his crying didn't stop, his dad promptly pulled to the side of the road, hopped out of the car, took him out, put him on the pavement, and drove off. At the age of 3, his father started beating him, and I mean broken ribs, broken jaws, hospitalization beating. You will cry if I tell you this guy's story. At the age of 12, he finally runs away to save his life. And the consequences abound. One of the questions he asks me is, how can I honor my father? Another lady, she's in retirement already. The biggest struggle she has is, after what my father did with me, how can I possibly honor my father? Because the Ten Commandments says, honor your father and your mother. I can't bring myself, she says, to honor my father after what he's done to me. Luckily, the Ten Commandment of honoring your father and your mother does not mean that you've got to allow them to use you as a doormat. The Hebrew there and the Hebrew culture is quite different. I don't have time to go into that this morning. But what I'm trying to share with you is these consequences don't just hit you the month after you've been abused. Whether it's sexual or physical makes no difference. The consequences can hit you years later, sometimes for the first time, and in most cases will continue unless they seek professional counseling to get healing, or unless God performs a miracle, can continue throughout their lives. These things are really serious. So, what are the consequences of sexual abuse? There's basically roughly about 19 consequences that I'll share with you, and I'll just quickly go over them. If you have been abused, see if you're suffering from these consequences. If you're a parent, make notes of what these consequences are, because when you start seeing a multiple of these consequences in your kids, it's time to ask questions. It's time to find out what went on or what's going on. It's time to take action. These are red flags that tells you that something's wrong. Number one, and they're in no particular order, by the way, is many times people who have been abused isolate themselves. They go into isolation. They become loners. Physically or emotionally, they just withdraw. So when you get onto school campus and everybody's got friends, but Johnny doesn't have any friends and is always playing by himself and alone, that's something to start asking questions about, because they isolate. Number two, depression and anxiety, and especially over relationships. I don't have time this morning to speak on depression and anxiety, but very, very quickly, depression tends to look back. And I'm not talking about medical depression. There's circumstantial depression and there's medical depression. They're different. Circumstantial depression is caused by things that go wrong. If I lost my job tomorrow, and my wife would leave me tomorrow, and my kids would have nothing to do with me tomorrow, then those circumstances would obviously leave me feeling down in the dumps. I'd be depressed. That would be normal. If I fail an important test Monday, I'm going to feel down and be depressed for a day or two. But guess what? If the following week I ace a test, I'm fine. Circumstantial depression comes and goes depending on the changes that happen in the circumstances. All of us, all human beings, are happier and sadder depending on what happens to us. That's normal. But depression typically comes from something that happened in the past, if it's not medical depression, circumstantial depression. You know that you've got more serious depression if, when you feel down from something that happened, you don't recover well and you don't recover fast. If I walk out of this church today at the end of the sermon, and half the audience walk out, and when you shake my hand, you say, Pastor, you're a disgrace. That was the worst sermon I've ever heard in my life. Give up preaching. I might feel terrible and that I've let God down, etc., and I'll be somewhat depressed. However, I shouldn't be depressed for 2 months. After a few days or a week or so, I should bounce back. That's normal and that's healthy. When you don't bounce back, then perhaps it's not just circumstantial depression you're dealing with. There are many medical reasons for depression. From not getting enough vitamin B, not getting enough sun hitting your skin, vitamin D, to thyroid issues, to dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine chemicals in the brain. There's all sorts of reasons why you could have it. But that's another topic. That's more medically driven. So depression typically looks back. And the past is influencing how you feel. What happened is influencing how you feel and making you feel down. Anxiety is exactly the opposite. Anxiety is looking forward, and you're anxious about that which is going to come. So people that have been abused suffer depression from what has happened, but they also suffer from anxiety dealing with relationships because they don't know to trust people. Is this guy going to abuse me as well? And so they've got depression and anxiety on both. A third consequence is low self-esteem. Now, you'll remember I said that the process of abuse really is a process. Sexual abuse is not something, typically, where the perpetrator meets you today, commits the act tomorrow. It's a process of grooming, of preparation. And during this time, the perpetrators are brilliant at manipulating people. And they start indoctrinating the victim that somehow they deserve it. Somehow they ask for it. Somehow it's their fault. And that's why quite often when these guys are caught, they don't really have remorse. It's not my fault. So the person who is abused gets a low self-esteem because they're duped into thinking that somehow it must be my fault. Or perhaps this wouldn't have happened if I only did this or that. I should have done this. I could have done that. They start feeling ashamed and guilty and all these low self-esteem issues because they didn't reach out for help and didn't ask and didn't tell their parents or teacher or whomever else. Sometimes they either become aggressive, they experience aggression, or withdrawal, either one of the two. Some people choose one and some people choose the other. Now you can see from these consequences that it's a miserable life. It's miserable living with all of these things, day in and day out, in your mind, in your relationships. It's just not a good life. Now, especially with females, they get eating disorders. A lot of them get into eating disorders in order to help cope. Sometimes the eating disorders are an obsession with food. They will eat until they are really nice and plump. Shall I use the word? Now, nice and fat. And the psychological deep reason behind it is, if I can become unattractive, then men won't look at me. Then I'm insulated and protected from anybody wanting to harm me again physically. They won't want to look at me or touch me again. And so I've got to maintain the shape so that I'm unattractive to them. It's a wall of protection. Sometimes the eating disorders are the opposite, and you get bulimia and all sorts of anorexia and those type of things where the opposite happens, where it's a cry for help. But especially with girls, some of them get eating disorders. Then once they start growing up, they get into the teenage years, we find drug and alcohol abuse. In fact, just this week, I was at a seminar at Andrews University with behavioral scientists, and they just completed a brand new study. When abuse takes place, alcohol abuse spikes proportionately to whatever abuse that they've experienced. They're trying to escape. And so they use drugs and or alcohol to escape from the pain, to escape from the memories, to escape from the thinking patterns, etc. And so they do this as a form of escape. There's a direct correlation between abuse and drug abuse and alcohol abuse. People are hurting, and they're trying to use this to escape from the hurt. And obviously, it doesn't work. It only postpones you going through the same things. In fact, when it wears off, not only does all the feelings and stuff return, but now you've got additional consequences from the drugs and the alcohol, and additional trouble from how those things can ruin your life as well. The next one is big. Almost all people that suffer abuse, whether it be physical abuse, sexual abuse, psychological abuse, whatever kind of abuse, almost all of them suffer from sleeping disturbances. They don't sleep well. They get nightmares. They wake up. They can't get to sleep. They wake up in the middle of the night, and then they can't fall back to sleep. A lot of sleeping disturbances. So if your child, in the morning when you have breakfast, and you ask how they slept, and they say they didn't sleep well, or they got nightmares, you don't need to worry about it too much, but make a mental note in the back of your mind. If there's a pattern, if it happens regularly, that's a red flag. You need to start asking questions, and so forth. By the way, I would encourage you to eat your meals as a family. Do you know that high schoolers who eat meals with their families are a full letter grade higher grades than families who don't? That relationship you build with your child is important, because if you have a good relationship, they will choose to open up and come to you. When you don't have that meaningful relationship, they're not going to come to you. They're not going to open up about these deep hurts and things. You're never going to know. Eating together is a great opportunity to fellowship, to ask about their day, to ask about how they slept. You'll be amazed as to information you could get that you need as a parent to be in tune with what's happening in your child's life. I've already mentioned nightmares go hand in hand with sleep disturbances, but they get nightmares. When your child says that he or she had a nightmare, start asking what the nightmare was about. Is the nightmare related somehow to what the child's going through? By the way, if you don't sleep well, one of the first things that happens to you is your memory gets bad. There are four stages of sleep. And your body only really recuperates in stage 3 and 4, and more so in stage 4 of sleep. During stage 3 and 4 of sleep, your brain actually transfers the short-term memory, things that happened today, into your long-term memory bank. If you sleep but you don't get to deep sleep and level 3 and 4 sleep, then today's events don't get transferred into the long-term memory. They're gone. 3, 4 days, a week later, you've forgotten it, and it's not in your long-term memory. It's gone. It's gone for life. Now, there are some theories that everything that ever happened to you, every smell you've ever had, every taste you've ever had, every experience, everything is in your brain. We just can't recall it. But if it's there and you can't recall it, it's as good as gone. So it really is important to get good sleep for you adults as well. Your memory will go if you don't get good sleep. In order for me to keep my certification, I've got to attend many hours of continuing education every year. And so I've chosen brain science, neurochemicals and stuff as an area that I'm interested in, and have attended tons of seminars on brain science from some of the top teachers in the U.S. These are secular, scientific classes. They're not religious at all. They're not Adventist at all. Every single one of these brain specialists knock caffeine to death. If you're using caffeine, I want to encourage you to let it go. If you don't believe me, when you get home tonight, hop onto Google, and instead of searching in the search bar, you click on images. You know how to do that? Google images. In the images section, Google caffeine spider web. When you see the images, you will never in your life want to take caffeine ever again. They take spiders and let them build a web, and they take a picture of the web. Then they take the same spider and they feed the spider some caffeine, and then they let the spider build another web, and then they compare the two. You will not believe it. You will not believe it. The effects of caffeine on the brain is worse than cocaine. You'll see it yourself. Go and Google it. I challenge you tonight. Now, the reason why I say it is really bad for you is because, and maybe I shouldn't waste time on this, but very quickly, for those of you that know chemistry, chemicals metabolize and break down at what is called half-lives. So the half-life of caffeine is 3 hours. So what that means is if 12 o'clock noon, you take, let's just throw a figure out there, 100 milligrams of caffeine. What that means is by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 hours later, it has metabolized. So by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you've still got 50 milligrams left in your body. 6 o'clock at night, you've got 25. 9 o'clock at night, you've got 12.5. 12 o'clock at night, you have 6.25. 3 o'clock at night, you've got, where am I? 3 point whatever. You get the message. Now, you'll say to me, Pierre, it doesn't affect me. I sleep well. And my counter to you would be, yes, of course you sleep. But you have a stimulant that is still being metabolized in your bloodstream. And what that stimulant does is it stimulates your brain activity. And so, yes, you sleep, but you're sleeping at level 2. You're not reaching depth 3 and 4. You're not reaching depth 3 and 4. Your short-term memory is not being placed in your long-term memory. Your memory goes. If you don't believe me, ask yourself, now that you've had caffeine for a number of years, how well do you remember people's names and faces compared to before? Etc., etc. There are tremendous consequences. If you don't sleep well, the next day, the very next day, your brain functions with 37% less than the day before. I don't know about you, but I'm not bright enough to function on only 60-some percent of my brain. I don't have enough. I need it all. So clearly, these poor people are typically young people that need their brain power for school and for learning. And one of the major consequences that almost all of them suffer is they don't sleep well. Even when they sleep, they're at level 1 and 2, not 3 and 4. And then they're tired when they go to school. They can't concentrate. And before long, they start getting into trouble with school. Their grades dip. And next consequence, when they start getting to the teenage years early on, you find that they become promiscuous themselves. If you see promiscuity, start asking questions. Start asking questions not necessarily about, hey, were you abused one day? Start asking more subtly, how are you sleeping? Start mentioning some of these other consequences. You want to piece together if they're experiencing multiple of these consequences, because if the answer is yes, you know the answer to, has something happened to you? They themselves become sexually active at a fairly young age. Many of them have suicide attempts, if not attempts, certainly desires and thoughts. Many of them fear the dark. Memory loss, which I've spoken about already. And one that will influence them for many, many years to come. And it's part of the low self-esteem as well, but you find that they will second-guess themselves. They have difficulty making decisions. And even when a decision's been made, they second-guess themselves all the time. They're not sure. They experience feelings of fear, anger, sadness, guilt, confusion. When they grow up and become parents, they typically become perfectionists regarding their parenting. Now, if there are some of you who are perfectionists, not because of this reason necessarily, but because of your personality type, I want to tell you that even though your boss loves you because you do a perfect job, it's not good for you. It's not good for you. When we do psychological testing and assessments on people, we give them certain tests, and we measure different components of a person's personality and a person's attributes, and there's like a DNA sequence. If you're low here, high there, etc., it means certain things. Do you know what the sequential code is for perfectionists? I don't have to know you at all. You can walk into the street, into my office. I've never met you. You fill out a test. I grade it. Once I look at it, I tell you, you're a perfectionist. 100% accurate. The code for perfectionism is high on depression, high on anxiety, and high on self-discipline. Too high. And the reason why perfectionists suffer from those three things is because nobody is perfect. So when they look back on everything they've done, they never feel satisfied that they've reached the bar, because we're not perfect. So it leads to depression. Whenever you give them something new to do in the future, they get anxious and anxiety because they know they're not going to hit the bar. They can't. Nobody's perfect. It's not good for you. It's not fun and healthy to live that way. So yes, I believe we ought to try our best. Yes, I believe that excellence is part of what the Bible teaches and what God wants from us. But if you're hung up on perfectionism, the consequences of that lifestyle is both depression and anxiety. Not good for you. Not good for you. But these guys become extremely perfectionist regarding their parenting. Not necessarily anything else, but their parenting. They want to do everything they can to protect their kids. But there's a dichotomy. It's almost an oxymoron. A lot of people who were abused when they were kids end up abusing people when they grow up. A lot of people. So that is also sad that sometimes it gets perpetuated. Many of them have difficulty with emotional intimacy. They don't want to allow you that close because they're scared of being hurt. So they build walls to keep you at a distance. They can talk about anything and everything except what's going on inside of them. They don't want to allow you inside. There's a question in the back of their mind. And that question is, if you really knew who I am, what I'm thinking, what I've gone through, will you still love me? And they ask that question rhetorically. In other words, the answer is no. So I'm not going to share with you exactly who I am or what I'm going through, because you're not going to love me if you find out. They become the perfect parent or an abusive parent. They often create trouble for their spouses. And by the way, in psychology, we have a term called, where we say, hurting people hurt people. It's typically hurting people who hurt other people. And that's one reason why it gets perpetuated. Now, I'm not minimizing all the consequences we've talked about thus far, but the next one's huge. These victims have difficulty with trust. They can't trust people. They can't trust God. And there's salvific consequences. That's just a theological term for their salvation may be at stake because they don't trust God. Many of these people, as kids when this was were happening, prayed earnestly over and over and over, some of them for years, for God to make this stop. And then when it doesn't, it shatters their trust in God. This is huge. This is absolutely huge. There are 19 potential consequences that have gone over. You should have 19 on your list if you made notes. 19 consequences. So I'd like to ask you a question. Of the 19 possible consequences that people have, how many on average of the 19 would you guess a person that's been sexually abused suffers from? So, you know, if you take medication or you see medication ads on TV, they tell you for 29 seconds about all the wonderful things these medications does, and then for the last 5 seconds, the guy or girl, so fast that you can't even hear what he's saying, may cause heart disease, liver disease, may die, blood clots. You know what I'm talking about, right? Now, they've got to do that legally just to cover themselves so that if you get the consequence, you can't sue them. But in actual fact, there's almost nobody that suffers all those consequences. You may just suffer one of them or two of them. And another person might suffer from another one or two or three. But the chances of you getting all of those long lists of side effects are extremely low. When they test these things, sometimes it's one person in 100 that even gets a side effect. Now, I'm not saying all medications are safe. There are some that have more risk than others. But those are the side effects that you get. You're not going to get all of them. So of these side effects of sexual abuse, how many do you think the average person of the 19 will suffer? Throw out a number. 3, anybody else? 15 plus. What that tells you is that a person that has been sexually abused, unless God performs a miracle, unless they get help to overcome, has a horrible life. You suffer 15 or so on average of the 19. Now, you may not suffer all of them at the same time. Some of them will kick in as you get a bit older. Some of them will kick in when you become a parent. Some of them, they kick in over phases, over time. But over the course of your life, you tend to experience 15 or more of the 19 consequences. For boys, it's typically one less than females because the eating disorders are not so prevalent with boys than what they are with girls. So you can see from this that it's a huge problem. They come to conclusions about God. Typically, they reach one or two conclusions if they were a believer to begin with. Conclusion number one is they say God is useless or he doesn't exist. Why? Because for all the time that this happened, they prayed earnestly for God to make it stop. It didn't stop, so therefore either God doesn't exist, or if he does exist, he certainly doesn't care about me. Many of them end up canceling their relationship with God. This is serious stuff. Real serious stuff. Where does somebody who believes that God doesn't care about me get hope from? Who do they go to for comfort? So what can we do to prevent abuse? I only have 10 minutes left. I really have to hurry. I've got a lot to cover with you today. Number one, training is really very helpful. In training specifically, look for the grooming patterns. Because the purpose of training is for you to spot things before they happen so that you can actually prevent them from happening in the first place. Prevention is always better than cure. So training really helps so you can understand the grooming process so that you know what to look for. Number two, cautious vigilance with your own kids and with other kids, whether it be at the church or the school or whatever. Be cautious. Be vigilant. Number three, a lot of common sense can prevent opportunity from existing so that these perpetrators won't have free rein. Use a two-person rule, two-adult rule, or a group of kids. If I'm the Pathfinder leader at my church, and we're going bowling tonight, and I'm going to have a car full of kids, I will never take the kids back to their homes, ever. Want to know why not? Because I've got four kids in the car, right? I drop off your kid. How many have got left in the car? Three. I drop off your kid. How many have left in the car? Two. I drop off your kid. How many have got left in the car? That's a problem. For me to be alone with a kid, to drive to that last house, is a problem. Now, I am not a perpetrator, but I'm a pastor. If that kid or the parents make one accusation, I'm toast. I've lost my job. How do I prove my innocence? You were alone in the car. How do you prove your innocence? In today's world, they will believe the kid above you. And sometimes for good reason. If you're a parent, by the way, and your kid says something that he or she has been abused, I beg of you, parents, believe them. Believe them. Take their side. Take action to protect them. I can tell you as a counselor and as a therapist, many families have been broken up and kids and parents' relationships shattered forever because the parents did not believe the child. And the child comes to the conclusion, not only are the perpetrator not there for me, not only is God not there for me, but even my own parents are not there for me. So having a common sense two-person rule is always there to both protect the kids, but also to protect you from false accusation. Don't drive with somebody else's kid in your car alone, two adults or a group of kids. So I don't mind, people, we're going out for boating tonight. All of you bring your kids to the church. I'll drive from here. If I've got a group in my car, fine. And when the night is over, I will meet you all here and with the same group. I will not drop them off at individual places. If you're teaching Sabbath school classes, try and have two adults in there or a group of kids. If there's just one, no. Just common sense things to prevent things from happening. If you've got to be alone, open door, open windows so people can see in. I will not counsel a lady alone. I just won't do it. If you want privacy, let's meet in potluck. We can sit in one corner where nobody can hear what we say, but everybody can see us. Want to be in plain sight. Or come when my secretary's here. We'll make her sit in such a way that she can see us, even but can't hear what we say. Just common sense things to protect yourself and to protect other people. Listen to your children. Listen to their conversations. Listen to when they play. Listen to when they pray. Sometimes they say things that can alert you. And then you need to ask further questions afterwards when the time is right. And always take the issue seriously. Don't minimize it. You mean Uncle? No way. I've known him for my whole life. He'll never do something like that. No, believe your kid. Believe your kid, especially if they're very young. They won't come up with this stuff by themselves. So, what can you do after the fact? I've only got 4 minutes left. Number one, it really is important to report abuse. It doesn't matter how much you respect or love the person in question, report it. It's not your job to investigate whether it's true or not. Simply report it, they'll investigate. Now, a word of caution. Only report it if you are reasonably suspicious that there's truth to it. You don't want to be ruining somebody's life for no reason at all. But at the same time, remember that these perpetrators, 99% of the time, have multiple victims. Which means if you don't report it to bring a stop to it, they will continue. And many other people will suffer as a result. Somebody has to step up and stop the cycle. So please report. Now, in California, many of us are mandated reporters. I'm a mandated reporter because of my training and my position. All pastors are mandated reporters. Bible workers are mandated reporters. If this church has a church secretary, if this church secretary has access to the pastor's records, then that secretary becomes a mandated reporter as well. Dentists, doctors, there's all sorts of professions that are mandated reporters, which means that if I'm reasonably suspicious that something happened, I have to report. Now, you might not be a mandated reporter, but you might want to report simply because of ethics. It's the right thing to do. So, what can you do to help the victim? Now, a word of caution. If you are not a trained and licensed therapist or psychologist or counselor, please don't act in that role. You can cause more hurt and damage. So, it's important to realize your limitations. Be there for them, and I'll share some things you can do, but don't act as counselor. And don't let them feel like you're the counselor and that all they need is you, and therefore they don't go and seek help. That's dangerous. In fact, in my profession, it's called malpractice. Don't do that. But there are things you can do. You can help the victims make sense of what happened. Remember I told you the story of this guy who came into my office from the age of 3, was dumped outside the car and beaten his whole life until age 12, he ran away. I say to him, why did your father beat you all those years like that? Now, the reason I ask that question is not because he might not know the real reason. And quite frankly, I don't care what the reason is. It doesn't make it right. But the reason I want to ask that question is I'm listening at his response. Does he make sense of what happened or not? If he's got a plausible explanation to explain it, the psychological pain that he goes through is much less than when he doesn't. And so I sit there and listen, and he says to me, I have no idea. I have no idea why my father would do something like that. Now, that tells me, psychologically speaking, his brain has not processed it through. The amount of pain he's suffering as a result is tremendous. So I want him to make sense of what happened. Unfortunately, I don't have time to complete, I'm supposed to end right now, the section, but just ask questions to help the person make sense of what happened. Not to justify it, simply to make sense of it, to get answers. Number two, you can help them to rewrite their stories, to help redefine their identity. I need another hour, but very quickly, we cannot change what happened, but we can change our interpretation of what happened. And that interpretation has a huge impact on the amount of pain we feel or don't feel. Let me give you a quick example. I'll just go 3-4 minutes over time. You sure? Okay. What is your name, sir?
Kong.
Say again?
Kong.
Kong?
Yeah.
Okay. Excuse me if I don't pronounce it right. Kong. Kong and I are great friends. So Kong stands outside in the pavement, and he's talking to his wife. And all of a sudden, I'm standing there, a part of the conversation. All of a sudden, I lunge forward with force, and I bump Kong that he smashes himself onto the pavement. Now, psychology says every single thing that you experience, everything that you go through, you are interpreting the motives. You can't help it. That's being human. So when he's lying there in pain on the pavement, perhaps with a broken arm, the normal human being, he asks himself, why did Pierre do that? And the typical conclusion is, well, Pierre is a mean guy. He's a terrible guy. He's got anger issues. He hates me. He wants to get back at me because I made a joke of him last week or whatever else, okay? Typically, they're negative. Now, given those type of interpretations of what just happened, how's he going to feel about me? He's going to be angry at me, right? I caused him pain. I shoved him. He's angry at me. Now, what if, as he helps himself up, he saw the bus that lost control and that came over the spot where he stood, and he realized the reason why I shoved him like that was because I saw the bus and bumped him out of the way to save his life. How does that now change his attitude towards me? Before he knew about the bus, that anger, that mean peer, he's a terrible person, I never want to see him again, I hate that guy, etc. Now all of a sudden, I love you, brother. Right? So the exact same behavior can be reinterpreted. We can't change what happened, but reinterpretation of the reasons why it happened can change our pain. Did you get the point? Without the bus, there's pain between us. He's mad at me. He starts ill-treating me. And before long, I start ill-treating him back, and our relationship goes south from there. But with this reinterpretation of the motive was pure. Even though my arm is broken, and even though it was hurt, I could have been killed. So the reinterpretation changes the emotional pain, the relational pain, etc. And this is something you can do to help people overcome. Simply be there and listen to their stories. Encourage them to talk. And then just ask the question to reinterpret motive. Why do you suppose he did it? I don't know. He's mean. He does it to everybody, etc. He may well. But could it be that perhaps he was abused growing up? I'm not justifying it. I'm not saying it was right, but at least we'll understand that he may think it's normal. That's how he grew up. That's how his family was. Now, never excuse it. Never say it's right. But try and help them to question their interpretation to a more favorable interpretation, because that changes the pain. Now, don't be a therapist. Just ask and listen and be there for them. By the way, there's a lot of research that shows that speaking to a dog has similar benefits than speaking to a therapist. I'm not minimizing what therapists do. I'm a certified counselor myself. But there's an important reason as to why talking is beneficial for us, especially when we deal with pain and deep issues. Your brain does not work in language. The human brain functions with thoughts, feelings, ideas, concepts. Language is in a total separate part of the brain, and language is something we learn to encode these thoughts, feelings, concepts, ideas, etc., so that you can understand what I'm trying to convey. But I don't naturally think in words. I think in concepts, ideas, feelings, etc., etc. So when you speak verbally out loud about what these concepts and these feelings and emotions and everything are inside of you, the brain physically has to process it from where these emotions are seated in the middle part of the brain to the top part of the brain where the language center is. And when the brain moves it from the one to the other, it processes it. And that process is extremely beneficial to the person that speaks. Let me quickly prove it to you. How many of you were in math class in high school, and during a particular lecture, no matter what the teacher did to explain it, you just couldn't get it? And it happened to anybody? Or am I the only dumb one? Okay. We've all struggled with that, right? The teacher does his or her best to explain this, but I just can't get it. No matter what I try, I just can't get it. I raise my hand. The teacher comes to me. I start explaining to the teacher what the problem is. And about halfway through my explanation, what happens? Never mind, I got it. Ever happened to you guys? Okay, what does that prove to you? When you verbalize, the brain processes it and puts things in place, and all of a sudden, you get more clarity. It's really beneficial. And so you don't need to be a therapist. In fact, don't take the role of a therapist if you're not qualified. Encourage them to talk. Listen. Just ask questions. Have them talk. It's beneficial to them. It needs to come out. And it helps their own brain process through these thoughts, feelings, emotions, etc., as to what they're going through. Help to restore their trust. Their trust in humanity as well as their trust in divinity, their trust in God. These people can't trust people because of what happened to them. You can help restore their trust by being a trustworthy person. Always keep your promises to these people. If you say I'll be there at 3, be there at 3. If you say you're going to make it to their game, you better make it to their game. But you've got to be trustworthy. To show them that not all people are like that, that people can be trustworthy. You can take that place and be trustworthy for them. Help restore their trust in God. And you can do that by making sense of God's actions. And there's two great things you can use to help them reinterpret why God, according to their definition, did not stop it. Number one, there's the great controversy theme. It's not always God, it's Satan. And there's freedom of choice. Love does not exist if it's forced. There's freedom of choice. God did send people to stop it. Some of those people said no. Some of these people doubted the calling. God did plead with the perpetrator to stop. He refused. But you can use freedom of choice and the great controversy theme to help make sense and change their interpretation, because their interpretation is either God does not exist, or if he does, he doesn't care about me. Change that interpretation for them. Please refer them to a professional. There's many free resources out there. They need help. Please pray for them. Lead the victim to forgiveness. Forgiveness is a major hurdle. Not only can victims not trust people, but they tend also not to forgive people. And as long as they're not willing to forgive, it's going to continue to eat them inside. There are many hurdles to forgiveness. Number one, I don't want to forgive because the perpetrator doesn't deserve forgiveness. I hear this all the time. There's no way I'm going to forgive him. He doesn't deserve it. After what he did to me, no way. I trusted him. I was just 5 years old. How can I'm not going to forgive him? He doesn't deserve it. Well, let me ask you. Do you deserve forgiveness from God? None of us do. Yet God forgives me. The way you can persuade them to forgive is that you're forgiving them for your own sake. You're not forgiving them for their sake. When you forgive, you let it go. It enables you to heal. As long as you're not forgiving, you're clinging to it. You're allowing that person to control your emotions and your feelings even now. Why would you let that guy control you 5, 10, 20 years later? By letting it go, you're taking control of your life back. Refusal to forgive is like taking poison in the hopes that the perpetrator will die. And it doesn't work that way. Lead them to see these things. Lead them to forgiveness, because that will take a burden off of them. Refusal to forgive is clinging to your past rather than embracing the future. Refusal to forgive allows the perpetrator to control you even now. So lead them to forgiveness. They have to forgive the person. Now, that does not mean, forgiveness never means that you're lifting protective boundaries. If you steal $1,000 from me and I forgive you, it doesn't mean that if you ask for another $1,000, I'm going to give it to you. And if they're going to say, well, the fact that you're not willing to lend me another $1,000 proves that you haven't really forgiven me. No, that's not true at all. Forgiveness means I'm not expecting the $1,000 you stole from me back. But it doesn't mean that I've lifted boundaries to protect myself from it happening again. We should have boundaries to protect ourselves. Absolutely. Forgiveness doesn't get rid of the boundaries. Forgiveness only gets rid of the consequences of what happened originally, and you agree to bear the pain and let it go. Lead victims to forgive others. Sometimes they're angry at parents because parents knew and didn't do anything, or because parents didn't believe them when they said something, or perhaps they went to the teacher and the teacher didn't do anything, or whatever. Lead them to forgive other people that may be involved, and then also lead them to forgive themselves. Remember, they've been duped by the grooming process to think it's all my fault. Help them to make peace with themselves and lead them to forgive God. Not that God needs forgiveness, because God never did anything wrong, but in their view, in their mind, God didn't do what they asked God to do. And so lead them to make peace with God. Lead them to God. And I'm going to end right there. Let's pray. Dear Lord, we live in a world that, unfortunately, we find that these kind of things happen. Lord, I pray for this church, for every member here, perhaps those who have suffered from it, or those who will encounter it in their kids, Lord, that you will bring healing, restoration, and most of all, that our relationships with you will not suffer. Please send your Holy Spirit, whom you have called the Comforter, to bring comfort. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.